This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek, and it's Friday, so we start right with our week in review. And once again this week, we start with an incident involving racism at the Museum of Fine Arts. The museum is still reckoning with an incident involving a group of students of color from Dorchester who were allegedly profiled and harassed during a visit to the museum.
I experienced white people seeing us as uncivilized and criminals.
I had to practice a lot of self-control when the woman said, "These effing black kids." She literally said it right in front of my face.
They treated us as if we was garbage, and I don't feel comfortable in that museum anymore.
The security guard was literally in the exhibit with us and just like circling around.
As soon as the student said that was what they experienced, I believed them. We have a lot of work to do in language, behavior, the sense of invitation.
Voices there, student Azan Rodriguez, teacher Taliana June, student Natalie Alexander, and the last voice is MFA director Matthew Teitelbaum. The museum says it plans to meet with staff from the Davis Academy next week. They say they're talking with Boston leaders about race and are changing the way the museum welcomes school groups to the museum. But is that enough, and what's next for the city's cultural institutions? We turn now to our Week in Review panelists, Reverend Mariama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend Mariama, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
And also with us is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Chris.
So this incident we're talking about here took place a couple of weeks ago. It came to light last week, still reverberating around the community this week. The MFA has since revoked membership of two patrons for making racist remarks. They've also said they'll update protocols for security guards. They'll introduce enhanced diversity and harassment trainings for staff and volunteers. Reverend Mariama, I want to start with you. Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece about this for WBUR's The Artery, and your headline was, "Racism at the MFA Doesn't Shock Me. I Grew Up in Boston." I want to start there. Is this a uniquely Boston problem in your eyes?
No. I think that racism is a problem in all of America. I'd probably argue around the world, but I can speak the most clearly about this country. So, you know, the MFA is a microcosm of the city, of the country. And I think, you know, one of the things that I find challenging about this conversation is kind of this, like, this happened, what are we going to do to fix it? Of course, I think people should make steps. But I think the reality is you don't fix, you know, something that was built over 400 years in 4 days or 4 weeks, right? You really have to figure out what are the long-term solutions and how do we get on a long-term path to change. So, and that's not to knock these shifts. If these are things that can reduce tension, can prevent misunderstandings, can shift thinking of staff people, I'm for all of those things. But the conversation really has to be longer, because the MFA did not single-handedly create racism, and it's not the only cultural institution that needs to have this conversation.
So the other half of your headline there, you weren't shocked. That's a theme we've seen again and again as we've had multiple conversations about this incident on the show. Why weren't you surprised that this incident took place?
This is something I've experienced my whole life, and I think that's the challenge. It's like, for many of us who are people of color, it happens so often. You are honestly, like, when you see your friends, you like tell a story about it, and obviously we don't really think it's funny, but it happens so often. You either can laugh or cry, and sometimes you just have to laugh about it because it's
coping
that
mechanism,
frequent.
Yeah.
So I think you know, what's good for me in this is that because it was talked about, because we are wrestling with it, we have the opportunity to actually shift it. And so I'm appreciative that young people and teachers actually raised it, because I'll be honest, there have been times where something like this has happened to me and I just call a friend and we laugh it off as something that happens often enough that we just don't have the energy to do anything concrete about it. So I'm glad this is an opportunity, a gift to all of us, to really dig deeper.
Yeah, and the students have been really eloquent speaking about the incident and their feelings. Joe, I want to bring you in on this. The museum's in a bit of a tough spot here because no matter what they do, some people are going to say they're not doing enough, and some are going to say that's too far and unwarranted. What do you make of, I mentioned some of the moves, they're going to introduce some more trainings, they've banned two members, they're having conversation with city leaders. Do you feel the museum has handled the fallout of this incident appropriately?
Not initially. I thought it was woefully inadequate at first. They didn't even call it what it was, racism. They were afraid to even use those words when, in fact, that's what it was. So I think now that they've gotten criticized for it, they've done some more moves. And I understand that they've made outreach, tried to be more inclusive over the last several years with their exhibits and with, you know, some of the programs that they run. But, you know, when something like this happens, when a crisis like this happens, you really have to attack it head on. And I don't think they did at first. They are making some moves now. Those security guards obviously should have been fired if that's exactly what they did. Or were they just following normal protocol? We still don't know that yet. But obviously, I think the museum could do a lot more.
Reverend Mariama, 81% of the visitors to the museum over the last 5 years, ending in 2018, were white, according to the museum itself. Mm-hmm. There's a real challenge here to kind of make these places that have been predominantly white institutions more inclusive. Mm-hmm. What does the museum need to do that? Joe mentioned a couple of new exhibits things, but what else can they do?
I mean, some of the things they're doing are good. I mean, I think that the MFA late nights, as someone who grew up here, I went to an MFA late night with my church. And I was actually shocked. It's the most people of color I've ever seen in the MFA in my life. I was taken aback, right? So I think that is powerful. And I didn't make it to the Juneteenth while I was out, but I heard it was even more than the time I've been. So I think that's good. I think that they've hired more staff of color. But I think the reality is, so there's what the institution can do, and there's also the reality that the institution needs to spark conversation with the patrons about how they're engaging, the conversations. And that also extends to the art that they display on their walls and not. You know, I think there can be an ethos in a lot of art institutions that the more exclusive it is, the better of the art it is, right? And that elitism can flow down around issues of race and class. So I think there's just a bigger piece. And I think that it's not all the MFA. We as people who live in Boston and the surrounding area also need to take some responsibility for the depth of conversation and the depth of shift that's required on all of our parts. And I do think there's things, obviously, the institution could do better. But I don't want to pretend like it's everywhere else is fine. And somehow just right. The MFA itself is just the one hotbed of racism in the entire city.
Yeah, there's been some pushback. The mayor basically said this isn't who we are. And we've heard a few folks kind of say, well, this happened here. This is who we are. Do you have a problem with that kind of that line?
I mean, if you're saying this isn't who we are from an aspirational perspective,
right?
I think it would be better to say this isn't who we should be.
Right.
This isn't who God made us to be. I would be in agreement with those statements. But this isn't who we are does seem to suggest that this is an anomaly. And I can say from my own life experience that it's not.
Yeah. You mentioned kind of the role of the patrons here and the elitism that can come into play at a place like the Museum of Fine Arts. So we spoke with the MFA director, Matthew Teitelbaum, this week on Radio Boston, and he talked about one of the specific incidents that the students brought up. The student heard a comment about her dancing in one of the galleries. Mm-hmm. The student heard a patron say something along the lines of, it's a shame she's not learning and instead stripping. And what Teitelbaum said about this I found really interesting. Let's play a little bit.
Frankly, my MFA has dancing in the galleries. I think that's completely great. You know, you want to invite people into your home. You want dancing in your home. You want the experience of people being who they are. And so the training, I think, has to get to the level of understanding what is the experience that visitors bring and how can we create a visitor experience map that allows them to be who they are.
So I do love that notion of dancing in the MFA, but is that realistic? How can the museum actually embrace that? Can they?
I don't see why not. I mean, here's what I'll say. I think that there are different ways of expressing joy. And I think that the reality is, you know, I'm a person who loves to dance. Now, my husband is the exact opposite, even though he loves music. You will not see him dancing around. Right?
That's me, too.
You know? And I just think that the reality is we spend too much time policing behavior that's not important. Now, yelling, so I can't hear, we can have some conversations like about that, but even how much sound is too much sound. These are all sort of differences of culture and personality. And I think we as a society can afford to be a little bit more flexible. If that piece of art speaks to you that deeply, that it makes you want to move, why not?
There is something beautiful about that, right?
How does that, you know, stand in the way of somebody else's experience? In fact, maybe you could look at it as her creating art in conversation with the art that's already there. So I think that our tendency to put judgment on things because they're different does often prevent us, not just racially, but across race and culture and ethnicity, from allowing people to be who they are.
So I mentioned the students have been incredibly eloquent and powerful in speaking about this incident. I want to play a little more tape from 13-year-old Azan Rodriguez. He told WBUR, unfortunately, he won't be returning to the museum because he can't get this idea of the hatred that he felt that day out of his mind, but still kind of had a hopeful tone looking forward.
Teaching the next generation to be better than the one before, that would look like diversity, happiness, and no hatred.
So I'll ask both you guys, not just the MFA, can Boston, can America get to that kind of place? And man, it's great to hear from the youth of this country.
I say not right now. We're not able to get to that place, especially, I hate to say it, but, you know, these incidents, we've seen them before happen, crop up in Boston before, especially at hockey games, at sports events. We've seen it. And, you know, the reaction of the mayor has always been to sort of be defensive about it. I understand that's what he, you know, has to do. But I think it would be good to say that we.
Does he have to do that, though?
Well, as the mayor, I guess he has to defend his city or something, but I guess he doesn't have to do it, but that seems to be his MO.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing for me is this is just not, it's not just a Boston thing, which is the other thing is, like, I don't even know if the people that got banned actually even live here, right? We as a region need to have this conversation. And I think, so I do think Boston itself has a ways to go, but so does the surrounding suburbs. I mean, we could talk about the politics of why we don't have diversity everywhere and all of the fights that are going on with 40B, which are, to me, deeply connected to this. So I think you're right. We're very far from it. But I think part of the problem is these things happen. Everybody gets indignant, but for a short period of time, and then it sort of flows out of our mind until the next thing comes along. And what I hope we can do is have a more sustained and nuanced and loving conversation about how we actually move forward.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of moving forward, I want to shift gears here and talk about Robert Mueller. He actually spoke publicly this week for the first time since he was appointed special counsel to investigate the election interference in 2016. We've had his redacted report for a while, and now we also have his voice.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
So he went on to explain a longstanding Department of Justice policy prohibits the indictment of a sitting president, and therefore charging the president with a crime was not an option.
The opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing.
But Attorney General William Barr disagreed with that. He spoke with CBS News' Jan Crawford.
I personally felt he could have reached a decision.
In your view, he could have reached a conclusion.
Right, he could have reached a conclusion. The opinion says you cannot indict a president while he's in office, but he could have reached a decision as to whether it was criminal activity.
So what do you guys make of this? Which is it?
Well, I think ultimately Mueller speaking, he did give some energy to Democrats and to the impeachment effort. But overall, he didn't really give them what they really needed, which is Mueller to say, I think what the president did was illegal. And he didn't go so far as to say that. He's sort of implying that what he did was illegal, but he's not going so far as to say it. And until they get Mueller actually say, and Mueller made clear that he will not be back to testify or did not want to testify unless compelled. And he's not going to give up anything more than what he said in his report. In fact, his statement was actually just repeating basically what was in the report. There was nothing more than that. Just seeing him, though, I think stirred up a lot of unrest among the Democrats, and it sort of led to more impeachment talk. But ultimately, it's not going to do anything to further the cause of impeachment.
So it's interesting because Mueller did say essentially that I didn't want to accuse him of committing a crime with no legal way for him to challenge that in court, knowing that he couldn't actually be indicted. So kind of referring to what you're saying there, that he could have said, I think the president did this. Mariama, what would you say about Mueller's remarks?
You know, I got to see a bit of it, and I think he's like, look, I did my job. You asked me to investigate. I investigated. Please stop making me anything more than that. And I think, you know, I think with Barr, it seems a little disingenuous, although he probably wasn't the one. I'm sure somebody told him, I'm sure someone from the Justice Department weighed in about what the parameters were for his case. And I think, you know, people want him to give a smoking gun. And I think he's just been really clear. He's just not going to do that. He says, what I could give you, I've given you, and you all need to figure it out from here.
Interesting.
I'm
curious what he was trying to accomplish by giving the press conference. I saw an interesting tweet from Maggie Haberman with the New York Times, who's covered the president maybe longer than anybody. And she said basically she felt like Mueller was doing that so that Trump would actually see what was in the Mueller report, because there was no way he was going to read it. What motivation do you think Mueller might have for holding that press conference if he's not offering any new information?
I think he wanted to make clear just what the Reverend said, which is like, look, people, I'm not going to go further than what I've done before. Hearing him say that in person, you know, cemented that, I think. And he's just not going to go farther than that. And him saying that he does not want to testify, that he will not testify, I think was a big blow to the Democrats. They can try to subpoena him, but I don't think that'll look great. But, you know, we'll see.
So, Joe, you mentioned that this really stirred up the pro-impeachment crowd. We spoke to Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley earlier this week. Here's what she had to say in the wake of Mueller's speech.
All of this is about Trump, but this is bigger than Trump. This is about the presidency. And this is about the dangerous precedence that is being set when we don't hold accountable the occupant in this administration. So when people say that we must wait, I don't think we have the luxury of that.
So you're obviously seeing a little bit of a split in the Democratic Party about what's next. Should the president be impeached based on what's in the Mueller report?
By the way, this is very much about Trump. It's not just about the presidency. This is all about Trump.
But wouldn't you agree that what we do here does set a precedent for future presidents, whether or not?
Well, it just like what happened with Watergate and the Watergate hearings, the same goes for that, too. But, I mean, I don't know what precedent you're talking about, justice.
Yeah, let me put a finer point on that. Nancy Pelosi has basically said he's committed impeachable offenses, but it doesn't want to move forward with impeachment. So I think it's that question of, are we allowing a president to cross the line without trying to hold him accountable? And will that carry forward for future presidents?
Well, I think the challenge is this. If you want to say he's done things that lack integrity, it's challenging because he told you he had no integrity when he got elected. So it's not like we thought he was one thing and then he became something else as president. I think he was clear about who he was before. And he got elected anyway. So that's where I think there's a tension because, you know, I mean, to some extent, you know, there are things in there that are obviously concerning. But nothing that I read said, I cannot believe Donald Trump did this, because I feel like he's being consistent to who he has always been. And I think that's why we have this existential crisis, because the wool was not pulled over people's eyes. And so, do we hold him accountable? Do we hold ourselves accountable? How do we deal with the fact that he's behaving in the same manner he pretty much always has?
So I want to come back to Speaker Pelosi, because she's obviously one of the faces of the Democratic Party right now. The Washington Post reported that 46 House Democrats are now calling for impeachment. Pelosi still has not changed the approach of not impeaching. And actually, she was talking with Jimmy Kimmel this week and said that basically her concerns are the 2020 election.
I think the president wants us to impeach him.
You think he wants us to impeach him?
Well, He knows it's not a good idea to be impeached, but the silver lining for him is then he believes that he would be exonerated by the United States Senate.
So, Joe, let me ask you, what do you make of the way that Pelosi is playing this?
Well, I think it's smart what she's doing, but I don't think she's ultimately going to be able to resist the call for impeachment. I think there's too much momentum. All the, you know, most of the Democratic candidates for president are calling for impeachment. There, you know, like you said, there's increasing, you know, because Mueller came out to talk himself, others came out for impeachment. I just think there's going to be too much pressure on her within the party, and that ultimately they are going to move toward impeachment. I think that's a mistake on the Democrats' part, but I do think that's what they're going to do.
So the impeachment process is a mistake?
Yeah.
Well, I think the question is it a mistake in terms of where the country should be in terms of what we actually stand for in theory? Or is it a mistake because if you do it, you're not going to win the election? And I think the reality is the answer to those questions are different, and I think Nancy Pelosi is trying to make sure they win the elections, regardless of whether or not she thinks it's right or wrong.
And that's your job.
History will tell us whether it's right or wrong, right? All right. So finally, I want to real quickly shift to our hubbubs, kind of the brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Reverend Mariana, let's start with you.
So I've been reading about these this idea that the Navy pilots have been seeing all of these unidentified flying objects. And I want to know, what is going on? Are there aliens? Are they watching us? Did they come and say, you guys are too much of a hot mess, we're moving on? I don't know, but I want to know what happened.
I love that that came out over the weekend. Everybody's like, oh, there's aliens. Okay, fine. Whatever. We'll go back to our lives.
We've got bigger things to worry about.
Right, that's what it felt like. Yeah. All right, Joe, how about you?
My hubbub is the National Spelling Bee. They held the National Spelling Bee last week. They could not come up with a winner. In fact, not only could they come up with just two or three winners, they had eight winners because they either the questions, the words were too easy, or the students have just got too good at it.
I looked at the list of words. They're not too easy.
They're not. Well, for the students, they're now hiring experts to guide them, to coaches, and it's a big money event. And, you know, they're getting they got $50,000 each. Eight people got $50,000 and a trophy because of it. You all get trophies. Everybody go home.
I mean, at some point, if you can't knock them out, that's what you got to do, right? All right, so my hubbub is a true unicorn in our current political moment. Bipartisanship agreement, and believe it or not, involves two fairly polarizing figures that are in talks drafting legislation together as we speak, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ted Cruz. Talk about two larger-than-life polarizing figures. AOC's a self-described democratic socialist, loved by progressives, but become obviously a favorite target of the right. She's taking heat for slips of her tongue, the wardrobe, or for dancing in a fun music video she made while at BU. And Ted Cruz, Republican senator, who's got obviously plenty of critics on the left, but even his own party, former Speaker John Boehner, fellow Republican, called him Lucifer in the flesh. These two actually started on Twitter. Ocasio-Cortez tweeted out basically she believes you should not be able to leave Congress and become a lobbyist. Ted Cruz tweets back and says, I think you've got something here. And lo and behold, they're off and running on potential legislation. So there is hope for us all. Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald, host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, thanks for the time, as always.
Thank you.
And Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston.